Accession number 18795, Real 4.
Yes, that remained the official policy. The next stage in my career was Billy Fraser, who was a managing director of what had by then become the British Petroleum Company, having changed its name from the Anglo-Iranian. We haven't talked about Anglo-Iranian at all.
No, I wanted to talk a bit about the impact,
yes,
if you remember it,
yes,
Mossadegh,
yes,
and the nationalisation,
yes,
in Iran.
Let's just go back. Billy Fraser came out on one of his visitors, being the managing director responsible for Kuwait, and I was told to go and see him, and he said to me, "Well, Tony, you know that Larry Craig is leaving and to rejoin Gulf, and that leaves a vacancy as head of public relations for the company. I know you've been standing in for him, and I'm sorry, but I have therefore to say that you won't be taking over in his place as permanent head of public relations. We're going to have to appoint Sabri Saman as a Kuwaiti as head of public relations." He said, "No, I don't think you will be very happy about that." I said, "No." And he said, "So, if you would be interested, there would be a job for you back in London, in BP's, then called the General Department, but subsequently became the Government and Public Affairs Department of BP. So that is what happened. I was moved back from London on promotion to a post in London, which involved a drop in salary of about 50%. that was because in Kuwait one was paid all sorts of extra allowances to compensate, I suppose, partly for climate, partly from being away from home. So those were my days, but in Kuwait. Then I came back to London in BP, where I was involved very much in the international and particularly Middle East aspect of BP's business, and where I pursued my views about what we should be doing in places not only like Kuwait, but Iraq and Abu Dhabi and other places in the Middle East where BP operated. I suppose the one thing that was interesting to me coming back from Kuwait Oil Company, where Kuwait Oil Company had been my life for 13 years, was to move into a small office in River Plate House, next door to Britannic House, and to file that and to find that Kuwait was just one file in a whole four-drawer cabinet of files. It really began to put the oil industry and Kuwait into perspective as far as I was concerned. But I don't think we ever really achieved what I think we should have been doing, because events overtook us and the Kuwait National Petroleum, KNPC, took over Kuwait's operations, and Kuwait Oil Company as a company really ceased to exist. I think it's still there on paper even today, but it has no business as such.
You went back to Ahmadiyya.
Yes. I tried to get back. It wasn't always possible, once a year. But then again, as I found my area of interest extending, I was going widely in Europe and as far as Australia and New Zealand as well, so there wasn't the opportunity to get to Kuwait as often as I would have liked. I think there were those in BP who think I got to Kuwait too often anyways, but there we are.
I'm interested actually to go back and record your reminiscences of, if you like, the odd political disturbances that happened.
Yeah,
first of all, Anglo-Iranian, when it was nationalised.
I think the one thing that was, I suppose, my first foray, disastrous foray into government relations, really, because I was sent over from Kuwait to Abadan to talk to the PR people there about their activities and in particular their filming activities.
What year was this?
This would have been 19. We'll try and work this out. I would think this would be about 1952, 53.
Oh, after the nationalisation?
No, before the nationalisation. Perhaps 51.
51 was the Abadan crisis.
Right. Yeah. Well, the first. I actually arrived just before the first riots in Abadan. And the riots actually occurred while I was there. But I had the opportunity to meet a lot of very senior Iranians and talked about the sort of the local situation in Persia. They were very, very, I think, reasonably relaxed about the situation. Anyway, then they had the riots in Abadan, and the whole place went on strike. And I was staying in their Riverside guest house. The strike included all the employees working in the guest house, which included all the cooks and the cleaners and everybody else. So there we were, I suppose about 30-odd guests of the company in their guest house, very nice building, without anybody to look after us. So we were taking over the kitchen, preparing our own meals, cleaning our own rooms, making our own beds, doing everything to keep the house, the guest house, running as normally as possible without any of the normal staff. And this went on there was no way out of Iran. The airports were closed and the border was closed with Iraq. That one of the guests that I was made friends with was a director of the Strix line, Strix shipping line, which regularly ran ships up the Shatt al-Arab to Basra. And we were talking one afternoon and he said, "Now, would you be interested in leaving?" I said, "I mean, leaving Abadan?" He said, "Yes." I said, "Well, we can't." "Well," he said, "we might be able to." He said, "if you're ready and packed at about 9 o'clock this evening, come to my room with your bags and we'll see what we can do." Now, the Riverside guest house was, as you might realize, on the edge, on the water's edge of the Shatt al-Arab. And just after 9 o'clock, we walked down to the from the building to the river's edge. And out of the darkness came a small motorboat, and we piled our bags into the motorboat and shot off back up the river to Basra. So I was able to get back to Kuwait that way, but it was
overland
another...
from Basra?
Hmm?
Overland from Basra?
No, up the river. Oh, overland, no. Kuwait aircraft, KOC aircraft were still running to and from from Kuwait to Basra. That was not a problem. No, it was.
Had the cruisers arrived in the Shatt at that time or not?
No. But then, having got back to Kuwait, I was called in to see Leyland Jordan, our general manager. Might be worth saying a word about him. He said, "Well, now, what's happening over there? What do you feel?" And I said, "Well, I talked to a lot of senior Iranians and they're all very relaxed. They said, don't worry about this chap Mossadegh. He's never going to nationalise anything." And of course, it wasn't very long afterwards that the whole thing blew up and he was, it was nationalised and we were out of Abadan. And the cruiser went up and brought the last staff out. One of the chaps who subsequently worked in my division in Britannic House was on the cruiser, one of the last to leave Abadan.
Who was that?
Mike Holloway. He died about 6 months ago.
Uh-huh.
But...
Now, what impact did the nationalisation have on Kuwait? Did you have to rapidly increase output?
We didn't have the ability to increase output rapidly. What we did have to do was to step up very steeply the drilling programme to bring more wells into production. I can't remember where we were, but we weren't that much further ahead than 40 must have been. I think we'd just about started the deep test well in Bergan when Aberdan was nationalised. So there would have been, if I worked on Bergan 49, we'd have been somewhere around Bergan 80, I think. Then the drilling program was very sharply stepped up, and more drilling crews came out, and the urgent need was to get more production. The North Pier was built. We had originally been exporting via two submarine lines and the South Pier.
That was my time, the North Pier.
Pardon? That was your time. Yeah. So the North Pier was built to take, that doubled the number of ships that we could take. And of course, tankers were getting larger and larger all the time. First tankers that were calling on Kuwait when I went out were the 28,000 ton. Those were the biggest afloat. And then we moved steadily up and we had over 100,000 tons. Even beyond, up over the 200,000 mark, they really were large ships, enormous ships in those days. That's really all I can say.
Leland George.
Yes. The other thing, yes, I was going to say a word about Leland. Yeah. A remarkable man, an American, and very, perhaps one of the best managers in a difficult situation that I've known in my career. But he got on extremely well with British and American. I never saw him lose his temper about anything. He was always quiet, calm, rational, and extremely popular with both nationalities. And very rightly, just before he retired, he was made an honorary knight commander of the KBE, British Empire. The other thing I might mention was the first threats made by Iraq when the Iraqis were threatening to walk into Kuwait.
That was Abdul Karim Qasim, wasn't it?
That was Abdul Karim Qasim, and that must have been in 19... Where were
61.
We?
51.
61.
Just after Pam and I left.
That's right, yes, 1961. And it happened while I was on holiday in England. And I remember sitting in the garden, in the sunshine, and my wife came out and said, there's a telephone call for you. And I went and answered the telephone, and it was Jack Considine, who said, Tony, can you go to Beirut tomorrow? And I said, well, yes, why? He said, well, just in case things go wrong, we are setting up a contingency evacuation plan, which should get all the British and other expatriate staff out of Kuwait into Beirut and to send them home in their various directions from Beirut. And we'd like you to head up the centre in Beirut. So I did. I went out and the next day to Beirut and set up all the plans, which took about 3 days. And then I had another 10 days holiday or so in the sunshine in Beirut until the threat was deemed to have passed.
What was this? Block booking hotels and things like that?
All the hotels were blocked. Flights were booked. Provisionally, aircraft were chartered.
So you weren't actually out in Kuwait when the army came in?
No. I wasn't in Kuwait when the army came in. After the threat was deemed to have ended, I went back to Kuwait, and the army and the air force were still there at the time. And in fact, I had a couple of RAF people billeted on my house because my wife was still at home, and they were had been looking for accommodation and had moved people into my house. And they were very pleasant people. One was, they'd come, the people in my house had come from Aden, where they had a large RAF station, and they were transport command people. And
they were based at the new airport, presumably.
They were based at the new airport, mm-hmm. Yes, indeed. Yes, that's right.
And a carrier came out, didn't it, as well?
Who?
An aircraft carrier.
I didn't see it. I know that they had a joint, while I was there, they had a joint landing exercise with the Kuwait Army, and the tank landing crafts and other assault landing crafts all came ashore from these transports out in the Gulf. I believe we have film of that, don't we? Kuwait Oil Company took some film.
Yes, I wasn't there, of course, at the time.
You weren't there at the time.
Left.
No, I think I've got it on video, certainly, yeah. on my own 8mm cine, which I transferred to video. But, yes, these were joint exercises, Kuwait and British services, just to become familiar with each other's way of operation. The Kuwait Army, as such, was a not insignificant force. It was very largely British trained, the officers, although I don't think there were any British officers actually in the Kuwait Army, there were British advisors, and most of the officers had been British trained. So it was a useful fighting force, no question.
Now, also, there was a British presence in the Gulf anyway. I mean, the warships used to...
Oh, there always had been, yes. The Ugly Duckling, the frigate, HMS Wild Goose, had based in Bahrain, and there was a Snopji, the senior naval officer, Persian Gulf, was based in Bahrain. And there had always been a frigate going backwards and forwards, just showing the flag again in the Gulf.
It's the visit of the
Centaur. Yes, so we were going back when the British forces were there defending to protect Kuwait in case of an Iraqi invasion. They were on active service then, but nevertheless there was still a great affinity very rapidly developed with the expat residents in Kuwait, mostly, of course, from Kuwait Oil Company. And then we had the visit of the Centaur in 1959, I think. And that was just a courtesy visit, and of course they were there for about a week, and that was the most marvellous time, because families adopted crew members, I don't know how many people were left on the ship at night, but there must have been a good few staying overnight in Ahmadi, because there was very, very limited air conditioning on the aircraft carrier at that time. And, of course, they all very much welcomed the cool of the air-conditioned Ahmadi houses. So, that was a highly successful visit. But by British forces. And I think it's probably true to say now that Kuwaitis on the whole regard Britain and the British as favourably as they regard any other nation. They're a very independently minded people, the Kuwaitis. They created a certain amount of resentment in other Arab countries because of their oil wealth, particularly, for example, in Egypt and Syria, where the Kuwaitis in the early days tended to go on holiday and spend, as it were. And the Egyptians didn't take to that very kindly, almost like the Americans in London spending at the end of the war.
I think you were equally horrified as I was at the Gulf War and the destruction of the Kuwait we'd known.
Oh, incredible. I mean, I would love to go back. If we go out to Australia, in fact, last year when we did go out to Australia, I tried to go via Kuwait, but there was no way in which we could have taken advantage of the package tour to Australia and visit Kuwait at the same time. The flights were virtually all London-Bangkok or London-Singapore, and you couldn't break your journey en route to Singapore. But I would love to go back and see just what has happened and how it's all been put together again, because it must have been a terrible time for Kuwaitis and for others, any of the others. I mean, the deliberate bombing of the wells and setting fire to the wells, and the deliberate bombing of the tanker loading facilities where tankers were there, and turning on the taps from the tank farm to allow the oil to flow down into the sea. I mean, that's been
total vandalism.
Absolutely. So,
Tony, thank you very much for talking to me about your
pleasure.
The close affinity you've had for much of your life with the Middle
East. Well, I don't know whether...
I'm sure it's another experience that will hopefully build up a very big...
I should be interested to listen to it myself again.